Hi, everybody, and welcome to Paul Listening Behind the Curtain. It's my opportunity to step away from the worlds of politics and law that you watch me cover on television every day here into the radio podcast world where we get to talk about arts and entertainment. And today, actually, this is going to be a program that is all about your skills and abilities and the development thereof in terms of how you communicate with others. So my guest, whose name I will say in just a moment, I happen to see on our WGN TV morning news, because if I'm not on it, I'm watching it anyway. And I so much loved what he was talking about and what he did. And candidly, because I share some of the background with him, we'll talk about that. But without further ado, let me introduce Michael Chad Heppner to you, whose new book, coming out around now, actually, is called Don't Say How to Communicate Effectively to Live a Better Life. Michael, good to see you. Thanks for joining me.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So we do share a bit of a similar background here in that I'm familiar with yours. It's, you know, communication based. You're a trainer, all this stuff that is in a past world for me. However, I taught communication skills for a year. My doctorate's in it. So my point is, I love talking about this stuff and how to become more effective communicators because it is indeed so very important. One of the points you make in the book, which I have read from cover to cover, is essentially to let people know for all... Well, yeah, but I certainly respect your work and wouldn't talk to you otherwise. But, you know, one of the points you make early on is to say public speaking is here to stay. So for those people who kind of put it out of their distance, whatever, talk about that just for a moment. The fact that even those people who say, I'm not doing any training, I'm not giving, nobody's, public speaking will still enter their world.
Yeah. I think people have way too narrow an idea of what public speaking is. And I often have people raise our hand in programs we do, whether we are focusing on what we call presentation skills or public speaking. Most of the training that I lead as the head of my firm is on this topic of presence or executive presence. And the reason we call it that is because most people have these communication situations that really matter a lot in their life, and they don't actually have 200 audience members. It's not some TED talk or something. There's a crucial meeting, a crucial conversation, something like this. And those would count as public speaking too. You're talking out loud to an audience, usually of more than one, and often it is in public. And we completely underestimate how often we do this activity too, of turning air into sound and sound into words. We talk, and how much we achieve in our lives in a variety of ways has a lot to do with how successfully we speak. So I encourage people to really broaden their lens of what public speaking is and therefore also embrace the idea of getting better at it because it matters.
What I love about your work is, another, it's a path that overlaps between us, is because we've had you on our air and you've done other networks as well where, for example, in the past election where we had debates or whatever, you would go on and give your analysis of how various candidates have done. So the importance looking at you is not just about teaching people, in your case now in the corporate world and related worlds, how to be public speakers. But I think it actually is a critical skill that you have to say, not only am I going to teach it, but I'm going to look at people who ought to be professional. If you're a politician, you should be a professional speaker. And let's talk about what's effective and not there. So my question is, when you're watching other people give a presentation in any of those settings, what are you looking for? What is the definition of what's effective? Because again, to use a point from your book, you say the skills that are out there, some people say, I can never be an effective public speaker and say, oh, no, no, there are skills you can learn and you can improve on as well. So what do you look for when you're studying a student or a politician or whoever else?
Yeah, this book, if you're reading it, audience out there, this book you will know is all about delivery. Delivery is distinct from content. You can remember these two distinctions for the rest of your life with an exercise that I have in the book, where if you just hold your hands up like you're looking through giant binoculars and put them in front of your face, you'll see that your left hand looks like a C and your right hand like the outer half of a capital D. So your hands can remind you forever of the first letter of those two words, content and delivery. And content, of course, is the words that you say, your vocabulary. Delivery is everything else: enunciation, vocal variety, gestures, eye contact, everything besides the words. Most of my coaching is focused on delivery, and not just because it matters a lot, which it does. It really does determine a lot about the impression you make on other people. But I'm also obsessed by it because if you help people deliver things better, not only do they sound better, but very often you unlock a virtuous cycle in which they end up saying smarter stuff too. So it's almost like a skeleton key or a hack to not just help them look and sound better, but actually unlock their best thinking. Now, with politics, it's actually, I have a little bit different mission, which is I am on a mission to educate the electorate on the difference between content and delivery. And it's a hilarious reason why. In life, we're often taught to try to listen to the content, not just the delivery, because the person who's speaking with not great communication will probably also have some valuable things and ideas to add. And we dismiss those people at our peril because they might have a great idea. Okay? But politicians, it's almost the opposite. Whereas some of them are tremendously skilled deliverers, but there's not much content going on behind. Or worse, they're trying to slip in really provocative, problematic, dangerous ideas, but they're doing it with such skilled delivery that we don't actually register them. So I would, if I could put my thumb on the scale in a tiny way for the electorate, I would like to help people be able to watch communication with a more nuanced eye, to be able to actually decipher what is just delivery and what are the ideas the politician's actually trying to sell me.
I'm sure you are very familiar. I mean, every public speaking teacher teaches this old research that goes back to the 20s, showing us that actually words, you know what I'm talking about, words are a very small part of the message. The research said 7%, 55% is in the paralanguage. All that. And so basically, kind of what you're saying, 90% of it, of that 100, really comes down more or less to how you're presenting and that 7 to 10%. Here's the thing. I know you would agree with the power of presentation, but we're in a different, that research goes back to the 20s. It's been replicated ever since. But since that was done, add in email, add in AI, which you talk about in the book, add in a bunch of other things that sort of say we are not in 1920 anymore. We're in 2020 plus. Now, how valid is that kind of research anymore in the way we think and process?
Here's the thing. My answer to your question is, and I mean this with love and humor, not critique. I don't care. What I mean by that is that,
I'm calling the researchers on that. They may not be alive,
yeah,
but
exactly. They're like, hey, you got to take this more seriously. Well, I do care about the research. I think it's interesting. I really do. But the reason I say I don't care is because what I really care about is helping people unlock the ability to do both better, say smarter stuff and say it more persuasively. And I think that's really my mission as a teacher and as a coach in this field. I will also add that your ability to get better at those things is only more important now than it was in 1920. So it's a trap to think, well, I can just email people. I don't have to show up. Well, tell that to all the companies who are clawing their workforce back from remote because they found there's no substitution for being in the office and having in-person interactions for career development, for ideas, for everything. So you can't hide behind an email. The next trap is like, well, AI will just write my speeches for me, and then I can have an avatar who will talk and communicate. I don't have to public speak. That might be not just inaccurate, but the reverse, which is it might be more important how we speak now. Because everyone, because of generative AI and large language models, everyone, and this is what I say in the book, as you alluded to, everyone is going to have access instantly to brilliant content, or maybe slightly hallucinogenic, but brilliant content. So then, what might distinguish the brilliant people are the ones who can actually deliver it with skill and persuasive delivery, not just the smart content.
What I think is really interesting too, this is here, I'm going to go to a piece you have in the book and one you didn't. When people think of Lincoln, here's the thing. When we don't know how somebody sounded for sure, when we don't know, we can't watch a video of Abraham Lincoln. Everybody thinks of his magnificent speeches. And yeah, I mean, they were incredible. And I think we all picture, and I think even Raymond Massey in the old movies, it was always Lincoln saying, and 4 score and 7 years ago. That's what we picture. When, as I know, you know, history and those who tracked it and wrote it of it back then say, actually, he had this very high-pitched, twangy Kentucky accent. It is such a disconnect with what, with the words we know he spoke. But here's the thing, you can comment on that if you want to, but let's move to modern day because I'm not giving anything away. You write about it in the book, but you worked with a politician in a previous election. I'll let you say who it was, who wasn't doing well at first. And then after a little Michael Heppner work, we saw a much better performance in a particular politician who people actually thought, wait a minute, this guy might be going somewhere.
Let's do it this way. I'm not going to reveal the name of the politician.
Oh, okay.
Folks, if you want to hear who it is, it's a cliffhanger. You have to read the book.
And you will, but then let me tell that I'm fair enough. I don't give secrets away. Everybody who reads the book will say, oh, that guy. So you're not like you're not going to know who this is. You will know who this is.
Exactly. You know, it's funny. You mentioned a vocal quality about Lincoln, which I would describe as placement. And in the chapter on vocal variety in the book, vocal variety means the music with which you speak. I teach people the 5P alliterative rubric or framework or naming system that I've developed for people to be able to understand and remember what vocal variety is. And it's pace, pitch, pause, power, placement. Pace is speed, pitch is high and low, pause is silence, power is loud and quiet, and placement means where the sound amplifies or resonates in the body. So when you're talking about Lincoln, what you're mentioning is like a nasal twang. That's all about where in the body the sound is amplifying, which you of course know. But we are essentially musical instruments, and the sound of our voices can amplify and resonate in different places of the body.
Could
Now,
Lincoln have done
go ahead.
anything about it?
Of course he could.
So you would have worked with him to get a more the sound we know we wanted to hear from Lincoln.
Well, that is a heavy question, isn't it? If I had a chance to work with Abraham Lincoln, what would I have done?
Nah.
That would be on my, you know, my second book will be that title.
Fair enough.
But yes, he absolutely could. And this gets at a really powerful notion in the book, which is people think they have a blank voice. They think they have a nasal voice, a loud voice, a blaring voice, an ugly voice. If you ask people to listen to their own voices, most of the time their reaction to it is negative. Okay? But they don't have a blank voice. Their voice is endlessly flexible, and it changes, and it changes dramatically after a nap, after waking up early in the morning, after having a good cry. Because our bodies, just like a musical instrument, like a trumpet or a saxophone or a trombone, an instrument you could put a mute into it, the sound of our voice changes based on how we use our body. So if that gives you a little bit of freedom to be nicer to yourself, listeners, audience, you don't have a voice that has some sort of negative quality. Your voice can do different things. And Lincoln's could have done different things. So if you wanted to shift placement, of course, there's exercises and approaches to do that. I'm not sure that he, quote unquote, needed to, but yes, he certainly could have.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like he didn't win for president.
Good. But wait, but before I move on, though, to go back to your question, the reason I mentioned those 5 P's actually was because the candidate in the book, he was suffering in a different category of these P's. He was speaking way too quickly on certain answers. And if you want to know what way too quickly is, try this tempo, 7.2 words per second. Normally, you hear people talk about rate of speech as per minute. I break it down by second because it's easier for a speaker to have a notion of how long a second actually was. 7.2 words per second. Don't try that at home, folks. You might get hurt.
And so that triggers something in my mind. And I said, I don't, well, I have questions. I just love talking and interacting, certainly about this topic. So one of the points that you make very strongly in the book is my words, not necessarily yours. Speaking is not about us. It's about the audience. It's about who we're speaking to. And so I want you to address that. But one of the things that I thought about as I read about that was, as somebody who does a lot of public speaking, so part of I have a very fast rate of speech. I know it. I'm conscious of having to slow it down in certain places. But it also depends where I am. Because if I'm on the East Coast, then usually as much as I speak quickly, the audiences are more along the line of, pick it up, guy. Let's go. Come on. You're in the East Coast here. Let's move. Whereas if I'm in the South, I can lose them almost instantly if I'm speaking in my, and I'm from the Midwest, but my New York type rate of speech. One time I was speaking at an international conference between the Canadian and US departments of revenue, and there were translators in the back who were translating what I was saying into French. And at one point I was handed a note which said, there's smoke coming out of the translator's ears. So, personal way of saying, talk a bit about the fact that when any of us give a speech, could be and it could be at a funeral, a wedding, so it doesn't matter, but it's not about us, it's about who you're speaking to.
I'm going to give your listeners and audience a little bit of behind the curtain on behind the curtain, folks. So before we even started this interview, and I'm not going to give you all the nitty-gritty, but we were doing some troubleshooting about some technical things. And you said this yourself. You said, you know what? Let's keep going because, Michael, you look great. You sound great. That's what's important in this situation.
That was a lie.
Well, fine. You own the lie, by the way, because you're right. No, you're absolutely right. The measure of communication, the measure of if it was successful or not, is not how did we look. The measure is did my idea reach the other person? We're basically turning air into sound and sound into words, and then hoping that those sounds will actually affect the other person. The measure of success is them, not us. So, in fact, you can go farther with this by thinking about all the behaviors that we think of as gravitas, confidence, things like that. They all are outputs of being other focused. Enunciation, eye contact, gestures, vocal variety, all of it unlocks when we're focused on the other person. Now, the reason this is so profound is because it's also a really good way to live one's life. I mean, every major religious tradition teaches this about focusing on the other, being of service. This is humanity's superpower that we can communicate complex ideas to each other and therefore team up, create a tribe, create a larger group that can accomplish more than a single person, whether that's, defeating the cave bears or whatever else. So your ability to foster other focus, it's incredibly important, both for your quality of life, but also, of course, the output of your communication.
And I think it's also about connecting. That is to say, the more we sound like somebody we are speaking to, whether
Yes.
there's many or one, they have a better connection to us. By not having those distinctions, we're not emphasizing the otherness, the distinction between us. And I view it as relationship building potential.
You're 100% right. So I'll give you two examples. You mentioned one. So you say, when I go to these different places, sometimes I change my rate of speech intentionally. And what you're doing there is this just very sophisticated, but also very intuitive human thing we do of mirroring each other. Now, this is partly so profound too, because how we use our interpersonal communication is a way to show each other that we're alive. We're alive in the present moment. And so if I react based on input that you're giving me, and I change my communication ever so slightly in response to you to show reciprocity and to mirror you, it's a very powerful way to remind you, like, I'm here now with you. I'm alive in the present moment. It'll be interesting to see as AI really takes off if, in fact, humans might even develop little tells and little changes we do to show that we're not a robot. Who knows? But yes, this idea of other focus, if it is the single thing that readers take away from this book, it is a totally valid and totally worthy thing to take away as your single concept.
You have a special skill that gives you the ability to do that. I'll mention that in just a moment, but let me add on to the point you're making, which is, so if I'm in the South and I find myself, by the way, the notion of putting on a Southern dialect can be intentional. It can also be unconscious, because I think many of us find if we go to another place, Europe, pick a place, that actually the longer you're there, if you are other conscious, you'll find yourself modifying the way you speak anyway. I think it's a natural thing to do. But the other thing you have to be careful about, I think you'd agree, is you can't take it too far. The notion of mirroring, and I'll add matching and mirroring to that, is if I go too far, well, then I'm mocking you. And that, of course, can blow up. But comment on that as I bring in, to me, the critical piece that makes you so good at this is you didn't start as this guy. You started as an actor. And I think that performance and acting is what had you exercising the skills you then learned or became aware of, you could teach.
Yeah. There's a couple of thoughts to share on that. The one is that the answer is yes, but also no. And what I mean by it is that I had this interesting aha moment where the first 5 years or so that I was running the company, I kept hiring actors to teach what I had been developing. And I assumed that they would just be able to teach it, and they weren't at all. So a lot of the concepts, yes, they do come from the world of performance. Other focus is a perfect example. But the specific tools in the book, like the Lego exercise that I teach for conciseness, like the finger walking exercise I teach for eliminating filler, like the silent storytelling exercise, which is about eye contact and vocal variety and enunciation, these are things that I developed working with folks who were in really challenging kind of doom cycles of feeling so self-conscious and having such bad stage fright that they really needed something very physical, very kinesthetic to get them out of that cycle. Now I mention all that simply because it's important that humans, well, all humans, I guess, but listeners and audience members to this know you don't have to be a professional actor to get significantly better at these things. Significantly better. What you do have to do is embrace the truth that speaking is physical, and then use kinesthetic tools to change patterns that you might be in that might not be serving you.
You're using some,
Yeah, go
sorry.
ahead.
Well, you're using some phrases that are going to open up a topic for me. But first, I want to go back to one. But when we talk about sort of difficulties in speaking or saying, that kind of thing, again, I don't give things away. You can if you want to. But let me just say that the title of your book, Don't Say kind of a trick.
It is a trick, and this part I will give away because it's a trick solely because I want to give people some help. And so if my answer right now gives people help, great, give it away for free. By the way, buy the book, don't buy the book. Whatever you do, embrace the lessons of the book. And one of the big lessons is thought suppression doesn't work. Thought suppression is don't think about. Then, of course, whatever comes next, you're going to fix it
The
on.
elephant in the room.
Yeah, as well you should. That's your brain's job. It's doing its job. It's distinguishing between one thing and everything else in the known universe. So we can't do thought suppression, which is why I titled the book as such. In the first sentence, I tell people that. I say something like, I promise from this point forward, I will be a trustworthy narrator. Every word I say or write in this book is one I believe in wholeheartedly, and each is intended to give you a better life. But the first three words were a trick. And the point is, I hope people pick it up to learn how to not say because they probably hear that in their head, don't say don't say but then very quickly realize, wow, I'm going to find kinesthetic, physical ways to change these patterns that don't fall into all the traps that don't work, like thought suppression and like general feedback.
And your notion of don't, and you talk a lot about don't in the book, you're exactly right. I mean, it's like telling a little kid, don't touch that, because the next thing that's going to happen is kid's going to touch it, because that phrase is kind of, don't touch, I'm going to touch, I'm going to violate that. The sad part is you don't have to be a kid to have that happen. As adults, it does too. So much of what you're talking about is playing in an area that I've done a lot of study in and training and teaching myself, writing about this. The world is called neuro-linguistic programming. For friendliness, it's called NLP. But the bottom line to this field, it began in the world of therapy and counseling, got moved in the world of education. I actually brought it into the world of the law, and my work is often teaching lawyers how to use this, but it basically uses so many concepts you're talking about. Let me give you this context for it. The key of NLP is how do we process information? How do we think? Because if we can understand the senses tied to that, it explains everything we do and everything we believe, specifically or mostly visual, auditory, and you've talked about kinesthetic. So here's the question I want to ask for you. And I just sometimes give it an example. If you think about your a relative or a friend and you hear their voice, do you also see them in your head? And for some it's yes, and for some it's no. But how you process and those three key things often determine what you will do. I often use it as explainer for if somebody calls you, you don't want to talk to them because what's happening part of in your mind when you see, uh-oh, that's so-and-so calling me, is this person, I can ask them a yes or no question and I'm going to get a 3-hour answer. And I don't have the patience for that right now. You're using your visual, auditory, and kinesthetic skills to do it. But my question that I pose for you is, given those three things, for those who have to make a presentation in my work, working with, say, lawyers for a jury, if you're a lawyer, you've got all three primary processors most likely on that jury, meaning some are very visual, some are really sound-based, and others are feeling-based, smallest number, but some are feeling-based. Part of your teaching, I think, just even whether it's explicit or not, but you sort of recognize that. If I got up and did a speech for you, and you're not visual, and I've got all sorts of images and PowerPoints with me, all full with images. That's not gonna, I'm not visual, I'm auditory. That doesn't do me much good. I need to see keywords. Can you talk a little bit about how the other's processing should feed into our own preparation as we prepare to deliver to an audience that uses a variety of processing, some visual, some not.
Yeah, of course. This isn't in the book. This may be in a future book I write, but there's a system of S's that I often teach for folks if we're looking at content, which is what you say. And the S's, I'll throw some out there. I won't give everyone all seven of them because it's a bit of a system and it takes some explanation. But
and
for
seven's an S.
Yeah, I'll throw out a few, though. One is succinct, one is surprise, one is story, these sorts of things. And succinct means how do you say things as briefly as possible? Surprise, how do you catch your audience's attention off guard? And then, of course, story, how do you use narrative? Now, it's important to get good at these things, not just because humans like surprises, being concise is good, and also stories are great. They are. But by using different tactics, you activate the different learning styles of the people in the audience. Some prefer stories, some like very concise communication, and you're actually doing each of these. Now, that is just a tiny part of the answer to your question, because that's just about the content, meaning either shown visually, as you're pointing out, or heard auditorily. So what my suggestion always is to people is that you want to try to activate as much of the audience's senses as you can, visual and audio and kinesthetic, because what you're trying to do is get them as sensorially involved as you can so they remember what you're talking about. I mean, I'll give you one example. I don't, by the way, I'm not an expert in NLP. You are. So to the extent that my answer addresses your question, great. And if it doesn't, please interrupt me, jump right in.
And by the way, I just give it to you because it fits so beautifully in the world in which you work.
Yeah. So there's a great book that I really recommend for folks. It's called Bright from the Start. I believe the name is Jill Tam, I think. I don't know. I might have got it wrong. But anyway, she's a doctor, and the book is called Bright from the Start. Jill somebody. So you'll have to if you want to. But the point is, the book is all about how kids learn and how to help them learn early on. And she does this really powerful thing about talking about how we acquire language. And she talks about the experience of learning the word dog in two ways. And she's doing it, pointing out that screens are not so great necessarily. We have lots of cartoons and computer devices that show like pictures and you match it to the word. So you see like an animated dog and it says dog and the kid like touches a button and maps one to the other. And this is supposed to be fostering a vocabulary. But then brilliantly, she compares it to a mom's pushing a kid in a stroller. A big, wet, friendly dog runs up. The mom's voice is still relaxed. So the kid doesn't hear a threat response. Like, watch out! No, the mom hears like, oh, look. Oh, wow, doggy. Dog comes up. Big, stinky, wet, smelly dog. Big tongue, you know, scratchy, red, stinky breath, tongue on the cheek. Smell, feel, hot breath. Little bit of gentle rocking and movement. And the whole time, along with the visual input of this big hairy beast, the sound of the dog slobbering or like whining or barking, also, you have the mom's voice saying, dog, look at that doggy. Oh, what a nice dog. Oh, dog. And so the kid instantly dog experience and it smashes up and you learn what this thing is much more profoundly than a little cartoon showing doggy and then matching the word. So speakers should be striving for the same thing. How sensorily can you activate your audience? Because if you do, they get persuaded and they also remember what you talked about. So I don't know how much that connects with NLP, but that's one of the ways in which I think about sensory stimulation in my work.
So it does connect. And what I thought of as you said that is that I have, when I do part of my presentation, whatever it is, but I will put up a picture of one of my dogs who's no longer with me, but she was a kind of a Westie looking dog, this white, adorable looking thing. So when I talk about this, just like you're saying, for people who are afraid of dogs or something like that, they see this very adorable dog comes up. And while the dog picture is there, a little red heart kind of flashes over her. And so you get this sense of awe among most people in the room. But what I ask them right now is, okay, you see that dog. How many of you right now actually, your mind went to your dog? Whole bunch of hands go up because it's about the personal connection. It's about my life, not me, it's them. It's about my life. And so you've got a dog, but I have one. And that's where my kinesthetic reaction is coming from. So this absolutely does tie together. by the way, for folks who are out walking their dog, listening or watching us right now, the author, I kind of looked it up while you were talking because I wanted people to know, it's Jill Stamm,
There you go.
S-T-A-M-M. So that way people don't have to be frustrated. There you go. And
thank you for that.
You're right.
Being other focused. You're focused on me and your audience. Thank you.
I'm listening to you, but I thought I'm going to get him that. So anyway, but I want to talk about something else that came to me out of the book, because when people are speaking, and let's just deal with a tough topic if you don't mind, but there's still issues of sexism and racism and all these things that you can't, I mean, as a speaker, I can't do anything about. I am what I am. And so you can love me or hate me for the way I present myself. But once again, if you're not liking me, sometimes we may find out this ain't about me. This is about you in the audience and the feelings you harbor. What thoughts do you have about how speakers can deal with the fact that there may be people in the audience who have issues with them for a host of reasons?
Oof, that's a big question. There's a lot to go into there. I don't want to talk your ear off. Let's kind of take it in pieces a little bit. One first thought is the following. That's not your problem. Meaning you, the speaker, and your audience is a bunch of biases and maybe people who have tremendously unfair assumptions and presumptions. It's not your fault. It is your challenge, meaning you still have to talk to that audience. So most of the time, what I'm trying to help people do is to embrace as large a possible size of life and bandwidth of themselves as communicators. What I mean by that is as much vocal variety, as much gestural freedom and ease, as much organic and direct eye contact as they would use in, let's say, talking to a Little League team at halftime when the Little League team needs a pep talk. Now, I know it has to be modified for the situation. You'd probably use more vocal variety in that situation because it's loud, you're outside, there's a whole bunch of stuff going on. But that same idea of using as much of yourself as is needed to reach the other person. Now, the reason,
I'm sorry to interrupt, but mirroring seems to be key in there as well, right? Because the point is, if when I take the stage, what you initially see is the differences between us, isn't it my job as a speaker, if it's the challenge you talk about, to do what I can to create as much mirroring or sameness as I can with you? So maybe my race or my gender, or whatever, it kind of steps aside in that person's mind after a while.
Yeah, for sure. And the reason to use that larger bandwidth too is because essentially what you're demonstrating is your deep humanity. Humans use vocal variety. Humans use dynamic enunciation when needed to get words out. We use these things beyond culture because we're essentially taking air and turning it into sound and then sound into words. It's how we speak. So if you demonstrate more of your humanity, not less, it's obviously easier for an audience to experience rapport, reciprocity, and empathy. Now, none of that is to excuse the unconscious bias or sexism or racism that might be in a given audience. It's not to excuse it or make light of that. But let's be real, the speaker still has the challenge of trying to reach a given audience. Now, there's a bunch of other tools, too, on the content side about storytelling and things like that. But, you know, you would be as much of an expert on that as I would, so you could probably do a whole podcast on creating empathy with problematic audiences or something like that.
And maybe we'll do that together one day. Before we lose time, I want to ask one question about dress. What do you do as a professional speaker? Suppose you're going to an event or a convention, whatever it is, and you're being invited, and the note sent to you is, it's business casual. So all of our people will be in a button-down, like we're dressed kind of now, in a button-down shirt, slacks. You can too. I don't. I always feel the need, if I'm the speaker being brought in, now I'm known on television for wearing bow ties and such, I won't do that, but I will do a tie or something. Do you dress beyond the required code?
Yeah. And let me give some advice that might be a little controversial too, okay? I will out myself because I have no, what's the right word? Not humility. I don't know, whatever the right word is. I don't feel bad saying my age, but I turned 50 last year. So I'm going to say this to people who are many years younger.
Mazel tov.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm going to say this to people many years younger than I am, which is if you're in your 20s or 30s or whatever, why not try embracing wearing much more structured and more formal clothing? And I'll tell you why. Because there is some pretty compelling data right now that a lot of the screen-based childhood, looking at screens all the time, interacting with the screen rather than the interpersonal dynamic that, you know, has defined human communication for eons before that. that interaction with the screen has messed up some of our muscles of how we speak. And so that our skill as communicators is getting degraded a little bit. And the idea that, like, I can just put on whatever and I can talk however I want, and I can kind of slur and mumble through my words because I'm just being myself,
Yeah.
is a tremendously reductive idea of who yourself is.
And that's going to be tough. Mike, I'm going to lose you now. So I with apologies for that. The book is called Don't See On by Michael Chad Heppner. Where do you want people to buy it? We can go to Amazon, but where do you want them to go?
Don'tsayum.com is the
Easy.
URL for the book. You can find me at LinkedIn, of course, Michael Chad Heppner, and also my company's website is gktraining.com.
Thank you for your time, sir. I appreciate it. We'll stay in touch. And this is really insightful. Don't say I'm great book. Thank you, Michael.
Thanks a lot.